Welcome to the Written Communication Podcast. My name is Kira Dreyer, and I'm the editorial assistant for the journal Written Communication, published by SAGE. I'm here to interview Dr. Chaim Noy, an associate professor in the Department of Communication at the University of South Florida, about his article titled Writing in Museums, Border Rhetoric of Participation. This article was featured in April 2015 in part one of our special issue on writing in ritual, faith communities, and religious practice. Welcome, Professor Noy. Thank you for speaking with me.
It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for contacting me. It's a really great idea. I look forward to our conversation.
To begin, would you give us a brief summary of your article to give our listeners some contextualization?
Well, the article deals with how people write and what people write in visitor books and similar interfaces that are located in heritage museums. And I examine two different heritage sites that deal with Jewish heritage and Jewish identity. And I do an ethnography of how visitors address the museum invitation to write. And then I do a textual analysis of what it is that they're actually writing. So there is an ethnography, there is text analysis and content analysis of what people think is worthwhile writing, how visitors understand their role as visitors, as expressed in what they choose to write or not to write. A comparative issue dealing with two different sites. So that's what this article is about.
Excellent. So we hope these podcasts can be an opportunity for our readers to kind of get to know our authors as scholars, but also as a way for young scholars to get a glimpse into the research process, both in specific projects or articles, but also in broader terms. So to follow up the specific summary of the article with some broader context, can you give us a sense of how this article relates to your other work?
My initial work, my PhD, which was done in 2002, which seems like decades ago, but you know, not that long ago, it was about storytelling and people and tourists particularly, and narratives and storytelling performances, and how people use travel as a resource for discourse and for talking about things. Because we often talk about travel, and travel is not just leisure and recreation, it's also identity, collective identity, individual identity. It's how we position ourselves in regards to various matters. So my PhD was about oral storytelling. And the only thing that I felt that was lacking in that time was that I was left eventually with memories and stories and some magnetic cassettes. That's how I recorded it back then in the 90s, magnetic, you know, tape recorder cassettes. Mm-hmm. I was left with very little material culture to deal with very little materiality. And I wanted for my following research to have to do with language, of course, and discourse, and in some sense, materiality. So that brought me to my large project, which had to do with visitors writing commemoration. This project was done in Jerusalem, in Israel, and it also involved an ethnographic approach and a linguistic ethnography approach about observing how visitors write in a commemorative visitor book in a very special site in Jerusalem. And it also involved interviewing the visitors, observing the visitors, analyzing their text and so on. And actually, it all appeared in a book that was published less than a month ago in July. So this is like very good news for me. And the book is called Thank You for Dying for Our Country, which is a quote from the visitor book, of course. You know, it's some visitors writing, Thank You for Dying for Our Country. And it appeared in 2015 in Oxford University Press with the Anthropology of Language series. So that was my move to deal with writing and the technology of the book and the materiality of paper within a context of commemoration and collective identity. That was done in Israel, and that was the book. But then I moved to the United States. And then the first thing I did when I moved to the United States to take the role of associate professor at the University of South Florida was to immediately seek a number of sites where I could continue my research and then have cross-Atlantic comparison, you know, comparison of things back in Jerusalem, in Israel, in East Jerusalem, actually, and in the United States. And the article deals with two major heritage sites of Jewish communities in the United States. One of them is the National Museum of American Jewish History in Philadelphia. It's a big museum, and it has a number of interfaces that visitors are invited to write, you know, who they are and how are they experiencing the visit. And the other comparison is the Florida Holocaust Museum, located near the town where I lived in St. Petersburg. Florida, and there also, they have a meditation room where you can write, and they have a very impressive visitor book where you can write. So to sum it up, I moved from oral language to written language, hence, of course, the journal written communication, and that's how, like, this very productive relationship came about. And then comparing Jerusalem with the United States, and this article dealt with comparing two different sites in the United States and two different ways that people can write and express their communal or collective identities.
Oh, that's great. And it's so interesting to note how our research changes over time, but also follows us from place to place. So that's very interesting. Great.
That's really nice you saying this, but that research, you're right about two things. One is that it evolved very nicely, and also that it, you know, talk about travel, it's like luggage, you know, we travel. This is like our cognitive resources. That's what I had with me when I moved to the United States with my family. I couldn't invent out of the blue research. You know, I said to myself, this is what you do. You do language and you do discourse and you do ethnography of language, linguistic ethnography or ethnography of communication. There are different disciplinary names, but that's what you do. And then try to look for something similar. I mean, similar in some respects, but then, you know, that you're able to make these comparisons. And as you said, this is exactly what I did. And right now it seems very nice. It allows all kinds of comparisons.
Absolutely. That's actually a perfect segue, because it seems like part of that luggage that you carry place to place has to do with method. And, you know, as a journal that kind of keeps a close eye to method, we're interested in asking, what were the special methodological considerations that came up in this ethnographic study of text?
Part of the good interaction with written communication is that I deal with methods, and I've published on research methods. I mean, some of my best read articles are about methods as such. This article in written communication wasn't about methodology. It was, you know, about the substance of things. But it's very important for me to say that, first, you know, when I teach, there is a conviction there that there's nothing that happens without methodology. Even if you go to buy some groceries, there is a method. There is a method there. So talking about research, there is no way to go around it. Or there's no way to put it aside. And it's always there. And the better we deal with it, the more nuanced our interactions with our methods, the better the research outcome is. So it's my way of saying that you have to tackle it head on. There's no other way besides that. What I mentioned before was there's a shift that I did from oral narrative and oral language to written language. And this is a major issue which has necessary methodological implications. There's been relatively very little research on written communication compared to most of the 20th century research on language, which has been taken to be oral. That was considered the spontaneous and the authentic expression. Ferdinand de Saussure, for instance, once said, why would you look at a picture of a person if you can actually see the person? And he referred to writing as a picture of language, where you can actually hear people talk, as the actual thing itself. So he was very successful in that. So in researching written communication, I had to come up with the methodology. And in fact, I used a kind of hybrid or multi-perspective methodology. There is one thing, which is the text analysis, which is that I deal with texts that people write in visitor books and other interfaces, analog and digital, in museum and heritage sites. So there's the text. But the text has too much attraction. Scholars are too much in a hurry to deal with the text, to analyze the text, to interpret the text. So what I did in my book, I refer to it as fighting the textual temptation or the logocentrism. I mentioned Jacques Derrida. The thing is, I left the actual analysis of content and the actual analysis of the text to later parts. And what I first did is to analyze the circumstances, the material circumstances, the semiotic circumstances. I work in museums, so these are very densely semiotic environments. The technological circumstances, that was part of it. The first thing is look around yourself before you analyze the text. The second thing was that unlike historian or philologians, I deal with live people who are producing text in front of my eyes. I do an ethnography. So I can actually look at how these people are composing texts. And this brings up really, really interesting substantial findings, but I'm not dealing with that now. I'm just saying I did an ethnography of how visitors produce and collaborate and cooperate in producing texts. And then eventually the last phase I did was saying, okay, now after all of that, we also have the texts themselves, so let's analyze them. So in this sense, I made sure that I postponed the actual analysis of text, which is so attractive, because the first thing you see when you see a text, you say, hey, what does it mean? And I said, what does it mean? I waited with it to talk about the environment and the technological and material features, then to make sure I have rich ethnographic observations and interviews with regards to people on site, in situ, how they produce the text. And then the final step, not necessarily the most important one, is to ask, well, how do, in light of what I've done until now, understand what these texts are saying? So it's like a multi-perspective methodology.
That's so fascinating. I love this idea of the sequence of analysis playing such a role in how you get at the richness of the site. And it's very fascinating.
It started mainly with my ethnographic persuasions and with the fact that I understand reality ethnographically. Even texts that were written 2,000 years ago, there is a context of their production. Maybe it's lost. And maybe it was regained and lost and regained and lost in different contexts. And this is the natural history of the text, as Silverstein writes about it. But it's part of understanding text now. It's part of the way we read text, which has to have this, I'm not sure what's the word, like, it's pregnant in this way. And if we read text, even if I can't observe people, I read the text ethnographically. I read the text for what kind of traces it leaves of the situation of its production, including how many things are hidden. And, you know, I observed many texts that hid many things. Like, people were writing a text as a joke, and you couldn't know it unless you'd actually seen these people, because the text hid the fact that these people were actually joking around with the visitor book. So the first thing was actually saying it's an ethnographic persuasion, and I'm postponing the mere or the literal analysis of the text to the last thing I'm going to do. I guess it's a rewarding combination.
Now, your article is comparative and looks at two writing practices and two heritage museums. So can you tell us what is the merit of the comparative features of your research, and what are the unique types of knowledge that comparative studies teach us?
Thank you for this question. It somehow seems that it leads very nice to segue from one question to another. It's a really beautiful way of knitting topics one into the other. The reason for that is that every time you ask me a new question, I feel like I answered most of it or part of it in the last question. Uh-huh. So that means something is going on right. So it's exactly that. Instead of just saying, I analyze text here and here, like in a National Museum of American Jewish History and in a Florida Holocaust Museum or in a national commemoration site in Jerusalem, Israel, instead of just saying I'm analyzing text here and here, I'm asking all those methodological questions, those three different perspectives with regards to the different sites. I'm starting by asking, what are the different material circumstances in the different sites where visitors are invited to write? How is the invitation to write and to participate in a collective effort? Because the visitor book is like a medium. It's like a type of media that's public, and visitors are invited to write. So how does the museum or the institution invite them differently in different places? And the fact is, their visitors are invited very differently to write. They're addressed sometimes as public, sometimes as individuals, sometimes as consumers. And then I move on to the ethnography. So how do visitors actually go about participating through writing in stating their positions and their emotions and their experiences and their identities? And then eventually, which is, you know, what we just talked about in regards to method, to ask, so how are these texts different in the different sites? So the comparison is not just a question of what people write differently, but throughout this process, how are the sites, the institutions, use their media to invite people in a different way? What are the actual differences between visitors' actual actions, writing practices on different sites? And then eventually the different texts and type of texts and genres of texts that are performed in those different sites. When we say visitor book, this could mean in one place something that looks like a book, you know, it's bound and it has pages. And in a different museum, like in the Philadelphia Museum, it's more high-tech-ish. It's like post-it notes that are scanned and go on the web and are projected. So it's more on the digital and less on the analog side. But these are all forms of written communication that the museums see as important for their visitors to participate in, and specifically as written. In all these museums, the curators and the managers insisted that it's important for them that visitors actually write handwriting. I mean, not type or talk, or just really use writing as a participatory action. So the comparison is wonderful. We will take all evening if I will now go into what I actually found. But I think the question was great in the sense that I compared these different sites along or with the methodology, which asks about the material circumstances, the ethnography, the ethnographic observations, how different they are, and how eventually are the texts telling a different story.
That's great. That's so helpful. My last question actually takes kind of a different approach, but maybe it does still have to do with method now that I think back on it. But you were recently interviewed as a part of a study conducted by Catherine Pavia on ethics and researcher positionality in studies of writing in religious and faith-based contexts. For our listeners, this work is forthcoming in our October issue. But at the moment, we're interested in hearing about that experience, kind of an interesting study. Several of our written communication authors were part of it. But we're also interested in your own insights into how your positionality played a role in your writing research in Jewish heritage museums.
It's a wonderful question, and I'll start by saying that there's a study that asked me about the ethics of my research. You know, I have a lot of accounts, and in every article, and it's part of the methodology, the question of ethics, it's part of the essence, it's part of the research agenda. But sure. I'm just noting that this was the first time someone said, I'm writing a research about this. Could you participate in that research? So that was interesting for me. And previously, I reflected with myself, discussing it with my colleagues and so on. So that's part of it. And I think that was the first point I'm making. I think it was illuminating for me to have been asked those questions about the ethics of the research. And it made me think, it necessitated that I think and rethink thoroughly questions of ethics. And the first thing I noted there was that in that exchange I had was that I think ethics are not universal. It's not that there's ethics everywhere that are the same. Ethics have to do with situations. They have to do with cultures. What might be considered legitimate in one culture might not be considered legitimate in another culture. And I think while it's really important that we keep our research ethical, it's just as important that we adopt our ethic principles to the cultures and, you know, societies we study. It's not a simple continuum of more ethical or less ethical. It's different issues that are problematic in different research contexts. So that was like one of the first insights I had. And it also made me think about my own research in different ways, making sure that I've done everything I needed to do, particularly with regards to ethnography. Because in terms of analyzing texts, the texts I dealt with are public. They are written in a public visitor book, and they're written precisely in order for others to read. So in this regard, I wasn't too concerned about the public nature of the material I'm working with. However, when I did an ethnography, that means I actually observe people in their quiet moments, personal moments, when they decide if they want or not to compose a text and how they go about doing it, usually collaboratively. And in those cases, of course, I always mentioned who I am and that I'm doing research and if I can use my observations. I still think that's a big question. And the last point, which you asked about, was, and I think I already addressed it in a different question, was that part of me being Jewish and moving from Israel to Florida was that I chose the first sites were sites where I felt most convenient in terms of research. And these were sites of my faith or my heritage. It had to do with the Holocaust, which was partly or mainly a Jewish genocide. There was other genocides being done by the Germans then, but it had to do with my Jewish identity and looking how it interacts with local Jewish identities and communities in the United States. And the National Museum of American Jewish History in Philadelphia, which again was part of my fascination with how Jewish communities, diaspora Jewish communities, which means Jewish communities outside of Israel, how they work their identities, how they work their relationship with where they live or with Israel or the land of Israel or the state, and all those very tense and highly ideological and pregnant issues. So it had a lot to do in terms of my own faith and heritage, where I study, what I study.
Great. This has been so interesting. Thank you so much for your time today, Professor Noy. Please take a look at our website for Dr. Noy's full article and the other articles featured in parts 1 and 2 of our special issue, as well as other podcasts with written communication authors. Also, consider following us on Twitter at writtencom for journal updates. Thank you to everyone who's listened in.